morning is United States v. Garcia, et al.
I may please the court. Robert Handelsman for Decker. Please bear with me. I have a cold today.
Don't get too close.
I won't. Actually, last time I was here, I had a cold, too.
There must be something in the air here.
It's a head cold, not an allergy. I will rest on the briefs as to whether paragraph 39 of the PSR is conclusory. The government, in its brief, really doesn't contest this issue. The real issue here is whether there's plain error review. And the briefs rely on Jaimes, I think from my high school Spanish, that's the correct pronunciation, Garrett and Allen, which we would submit are basically all force precedents for this case. Jaimes says that failure to argue a sentencing issue is a forfeiture, not a waiver. If sentencing counsel could be faulted for the omission, and there is no strategic reason for the omission. That is precisely the case here. The government argued in its brief that there was that counsel was arguing for a minor role, and therefore there was a strategic reason for not arguing this. We would submit to you that there is absolutely no basis in the record for that statement. There is absolutely nothing in the record to indicate that counsel stated he would not raise the issue of paragraph 39 because he wanted to argue for a minor role.
Well, there's never going to be anything in the record on that point. We have to conjecture a strategic reason in order to get out of plain error review.
I don't think you can conjecture that. There has to be something in the record on which the government has to hang its hat. There is a strategic reason. If a defense counsel came in and said, well, I know paragraph 39 is conclusory, but I'm not going to argue that because I want to argue a minor role in the offense.
My point, counsel, is that's never going to happen. And to apply this rule of the Jaimes case, if I'm pronouncing it properly, you pronounced it earlier, we have to essentially conjecture a strategic reason. Otherwise, plain error review is afforded. That's how I understand that case.
Well, I think the Garrett case says certainly implies, if not explicitly states, there has to be something in the record to at least provide a basis for a conjecture. You don't have that here. Jaimes talks about whether counsel just wasn't aware of the issue. And this appears more to be of that genre than a strategic one. In any event, your case is on ineffective assistance, say, that this should be done in an evidentiary hearing where evidence can be taken. If there's any doubt, if the panel feels that there is some sort of strategic reason here, I don't think you can get that out of the record. You would have to remand that for an evidentiary hearing to be consistent with the cases.
Do you know what that would do to sentencing appeals in this circuit if that were the rule? I mean, it's commonplace, an everyday occurrence that defense counsel states on the record, I have no objection to the pre-sentence, and then proceeds to make, you know, collateral arguments, but has no objection to the factual findings in the pre-sentence. And if every one of those had to be remanded for an evidentiary hearing about whether there was a strategic reason to forego objection, every case would be appealed.
Well, let me make myself a little clearer on that. I'm not saying every case has to be remanded. I'm saying if there's any doubt about what really happened. In this case, I don't think there is any doubt that this seems to be the omission that Jaimes, Garrett, and Allen all talked about.
Well, the attorney, and I assume it wasn't you.
It was not okay. Me.
Did go on to make the minor role argument, right?
Yes, he did. But as we point out in the reply brief, he certainly could make them in the alternative. I mean, just to say one sentence, and judge, if you don't accept this, well, paragraph 39 is conclusory. certainly doesn't constitute sufficient evidence on which you can base quantities, he would have made his record. It's not something the analogy I can think of is a quarterback trying to decide whether to call a pass play or a running play. I mean, this is basically a no-brainer. But with Jaimes, Garrett, and Allen, we think the facts of this case are congruent with what this court has found in those cases. Pardon me?
You're in your rebuttal time, you know.
I'm finishing up. But I ask you to base your decision on Jaimes, Garrett, and Allen. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ernst?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Vernon Lorenz. I'm appointed counsel for Paula Alvarez. I was appointed at the trial level as well. This case comes before you today on direct appeal, Ms. Alvarez having lost at trial by jury in September of 2007 and then sentenced to the Bureau of Prisons for 168 months in January of 2008. Ms. Alvarez is seeking relief in the alternative in three ways. She's asking, based on the sufficiency of the evidence, that her conviction be overturned. In the alternative, she's asking that based upon the issuance of the ostrich instruction, that her case be remanded back for a new trial. And again, alternatively, she's asking that she be sentenced to if the other two fail, that she be sentenced to the Bureau of Prisons for the minimum under the statute, which would be 120 months and not 168 months. Acknowledging at the outset that sufficiency arguments are very difficult, understandably so. Trials are living, breathing things. When a judge sits in his chambers or office or at home and reads a transcript in a sterile environment, it's not quite the same. We acknowledge that. The reason we think the sufficiency of the evidence argument is a good starting point and why it's important in this case is because the drug leader of this conspiracy, Jorge Bautista, it's Eloy Hernandez too, on cross-examination told the jury that Paula Alvarez did not drive the package of money, the drug money, on December 28th, nor did she take the money up on January 11th of 2007. Startling admission. And then puts his testimony in stark contrast with some of the other Confederates in the case.
Aren't those just questions of fact?
Yes, sir, they are questions of fact.
Well, jury's entitled to disregard one, accept the other, do what they want.
They certainly are, Judge, but when Ms. Alvarez was indicted, there were three major acts on her part that were alleged, that she knowingly drove drug.
I read it.
Okay.
I'm familiar with the record.
Thank you, Judge. So his testimony then coincides with Ms. Alvarez's testimony, at least as it relates to the testimony about driving, knowingly transporting drug proceeds from Indianapolis, Indiana, to Whiting, Indiana. She then asserts that the ostrich instruction was given in error because she didn't take the money up. She was hanging around these people on and off for 24 days. When you look at a lot of the ostrich instruction cases that are cited, there's some really bizarre, egregious, almost undeniable facts. She saw none of that. And you couple that with Jorge Bautista's testimony that she didn't do what everyone had said she'd done. The problem is,
as Judge Barr pointed out, she was asked if she was afraid, and she said, no, women are not as police are not as likely to pull women over. That's what, at least that was the testimony.
That
indicates knowledge.
Certainly, Judge. That was testimony from a young man named Manano, who then pointed to a spectator in the gallery when he was asked to identify my client. And as we brief, There's no reason for her to mention that. In one minute, she's going home, and before she knows it, she's driving back to her home with this young boy who was just placed in her car by Bautista. They weren't transporting anything.
But if you believe her testimony, if that's all there was, is her testimony, then she's extremely sympathetic. But then you have to put against that the testimony of the other witnesses. That's
why I acknowledge it as a... It's
uphill struggle.
It's like Sisyphus. It is an uphill struggle that may never end. As to her sentence, we ask that she be found to have, if the other two issues fail, that she performed a minimal role. If she didn't take the money, at most, our view of the evidence is that she couriered a courier. This mission on December 18th was secret. When they ate in that restaurant, El Veneno, in Chicago, no one talked about drugs. Didn't come up. And suddenly, for the methamphetamine source in Chicago to announce out loud so everyone can hear it that I put the methamphetamine in your trunk in a pillowcase is absurd. She, courier to courier, didn't take the money, and we think she should be found to have performed a minimal role. We also would ask, by way of relief, that the obstruction enhancement of two levels be stricken as well. Her testimony's in conjunction or in sync with Jorge Bautista's, at least as it relates to the money. His testimony then puts everyone else's testimony at odds with one another. And perhaps they all obstructed justice. I don't know, but it's our belief that Ms. Alvarez didn't.
Was this enhancement routinely given whenever the defendant testifies?
Is it an instruction that's routinely?
No. Is this enhancement routinely tacked on whenever the defendant testifies?
Only if the district court makes a finding that...
Well, right. I understand what's required before it can be. I'm asking a normative question. Is it usually done?
Your Honor, I don't know.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
I'll ask the prosecutor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much. At the outset, I would like to note that there actually, surprisingly, is something in the record in this case that supports the conclusion that Dustin Decker's trial counsel was agreeing to a base level 38 for a strategic reason. And I understand you've read the record, but the quotation is on page 7. Line 23 of the sentencing transcript for Mr. Decker, and the defense lawyers, it's preceded by a discussion of the base offense level, the effect of the salary cap for role in the offense. And the defense lawyer says, we aren't arguing and we understand the law in the area with regard to conspiracies, and that is that he could be tied to the total amount of the conspiracy. That's not our argument. Actually, we're using that as part of our argument as a minor participant. So you're right, there usually is never anything in the record about why a defense lawyer says something or does something, but there is in this case. Just commenting on...
Just to clarify, too, the 15 kilos that was attributed to him was the total conspiracy amount from October to whenever it was, January or February?
No, there is a dispute. Mr. Decker had said that he had only distributed somewhere around 7 or 8 pounds. Based upon the purity, it would have put him at level 36. The government's version was that over the whole conspiracy, he was getting... there were 5-pound shipments incoming, I think, every week, and he was getting 2 to 3 pounds of that. So by the government's version, he was getting more than that. So there was a factual dispute. But in my view, at least heading into that sentencing hearing, that factual dispute was eliminated when he he makes a submission to the probation office and then tells the judge, we agree we're at level 38.
Well, that's right. And this Jaime's rule sort of brings about a legal sandbagging of the prosecution, it seems to me, because if there's no objection, you don't bring in your evidence at sentencing.
Yeah, so. In that case, when I read it, you know, my first thought, and I guess my Western Pennsylvania education, I was saying James, but my initial thought was that what the court was doing there was that this was a case where bad facts make bad law. And in that case, you had a 16-level departure where somebody got way more jail time than they should have, and the government basically said, yeah, he's getting more time than he should have, but too bad. And he waived that argument. And this court really, in that case, grafted a requirement onto the case similar to Strickland versus Washington. They really looked at it conceptually as an ineffective assistance of counsel case and sort of imposed that standard, and I think it was due to that 16-level departure. That was very different than the Redding and Staples cases that preceded it, where this court said, effectively, the failure to object is a waiver, and the Jaimes case, or however we want to pronounce it, the court went beyond that and said, you know, we've got to look to see if there's a strategic reason, and sort of was bringing Strickland factors into the court's decision. But be that as it may, there are other differences than a 16-level departure. Here there's not a simple failure to object. There's an affirmative statement to the court by defense counsel, he's at level 38. And there's also a strategic reason that does exist in the record, although I agree with the court that it's very problematic to impose that as an across-the-board requirement. It does exist here. Moving to the Paula Alvarez case, the first thing that I wanted to discuss was that I believe, having tried the case and reviewing the record, that the defense, the appellants, mischaracterized some of this evidence in the case, and that bleeds over into our discussion about the sufficiency of the evidence and the propriety of giving an ostrich instruction. The first mischaracterization deals with the assertion that on cross-examination, and that Jorge Bautista said that he never took the drug money to Lupio, that Paula Alvarez never took the drug money to Lupio. And here's where that comes about. On page 629 of the transcript, defense counsel asks, and isn't it true, Mr. Hernandez, Paula never took that package of money up to Chicago, correct? Answer, yes. And there are three problems with that question, why it doesn't lead to the inference that she never took money to Lupio. First is a double negative. Isn't it true that you never do something? Is it not true? It's a very confusing question. Secondly, the question involves whether money was taken to Chicago. And the trial testimony was that the money was taken to Whiting, Indiana, not Chicago. And during the trial, there is a substantial difference in certain events that happened in Whiting, which were the two deliveries of money, and the delivery of drugs that happened in Chicago. When the question was asked properly to the witness on direct examination, Mr. Bautista gave an unequivocal answer that Paula Alvarez delivered the money to Lupio, and that's at page 419, lines 21 through 23. Were there, question, who were the other people that you sent money with to Lupio? Answer, Angel and twice Pavi. So that was mischaracterized. And there were many, there were several other things, and I made notes about three others, and I don't, I understand from the court that I know the transcripts are read closely by this court, but we really have many significant factual disputes about what was said in the appellant's brief. Having said that, to address the substantive issues in this case, the first set of arguments concern the ostrich instruction. And there's a question about the propriety of Judge Tender's decision to give the ostrich instruction in this case. And the key factor in considering whether the instruction should have given is whether there's no ostrich instruction. A court should not give an instruction where there's a binary choice between actual innocence or actual knowledge and complete innocence. It should only give the instruction while where there's a third choice. Now, the government presented a lot of evidence in the trial showing that Ms. Alvarez had actual knowledge about the transportation of the 5 pounds of methamphetamine from Chicago to Indianapolis. But if her testimony were to be believed and some of the government's evidence not believed, then that third choice of conscious avoidance comes up. And it doesn't come up with respect to the two money deliveries because she said she didn't do it. The other witnesses said she did. It comes in only with the transportation of methamphetamine. And her defense is, in essence, sure, there was methamphetamine in the car. We're not contesting that, but I didn't know about it. And the evidence that supported giving the instruction were basically the circumstances of her trip. She left Indianapolis with this Enano character, a young man who Bautista had introduced as her son, never asked questions. Why are you going with me to Whiting and then to Chicago? Who are you? Boy, I've known Jorge for so long and I didn't know he had a son. None of those questions. On the way up to Whiting, Ms. Alvarez gives an exit story to Enano saying, hey, if we get stopped by the police, tell them you're my mom. They go to this restaurant, the El Veneno restaurant, and that's not where this discussion happens about where the dope's going to be put. They go to the restaurant in Chicago and afterwards drive the car to a gas station. Ms. Alvarez says she leaves the keys in her ignition and permits somebody that she doesn't even know to come up, take that car, and drive it away. That's a shade.
It happens all the time.
Yeah, you know, and that's something at least that would give an inference that she knew what was going on.
Well, she didn't know anything was going on.
You know, and then she says she wants to go home to Whiting, Indiana, and she takes a little detour. Instead, she drives back to Indianapolis to Enano with the methamphetamine. And then the background, a long time before the trip that the court noted earlier, that she gave a statement to Hilda Hernandez that she didn't worry about the police stopping her because women don't look suspicious. So if you believe her testimony and discredit some of the government witnesses, and we never know what a jury's going to accept or not accept, there is a third option there where we have to question. It's not just actual knowledge or complete innocence. There's a third ground of avoidance. Then we go to the contents of the instruction, and the appellant questions the lack of this high probability language in the instruction. The problem there is the defense at trial never objected to the form of the instruction, objected to giving the instruction, but not the form. Never proposed an alternate instruction to the district court, and never has suggested what it ought to be to this court. I basically asked why in my brief, and the response is, well, the judge would have overruled me anyway and followed the pattern instruction, and it's asking too much of the defense lawyer during a trial to do the research and call into propriety of these.
Mr. Black, could you get into the sentencing?
Yes, I will. Let me move to that. Well, there are three sentencing issues. There's obstruction, the obstruction enhancement, the role in the offense, and then the guideline question. Dealing first with the obstruction for perjury, Ms. Alvarez's arguments that Judge Tender didn't identify the subject matter of the testimony that he found offensive, I pulled out a snippet of what Judge Tender said, put it in my brief on page 73, and it's very clear. It's very clear that Judge Tender disregarded her testimony and disbelieved it in total about the trips that were taken.
Are these obstruction enhancements usually assessed against defendants who testify?
You know, they usually are, but of course, usually the defendants testify at trial, I didn't do it, and the judges don't believe them. So, you know, yes, it is usually done, but I think properly so. I mean, if a defendant says, I didn't know there was 5 pounds of meth in the car, and comes up with this concocted story about it, and the judge says, you know, I don't believe you and I don't believe your story, it's proper. And in, you know, these trials, you know, defendants don't testify and say, yeah, I did it, I agree with the government witnesses or the wiretap. So, you know, yeah, but I think as a matter of propriety, they should be given most of the time. I wouldn't say they're given all of the time, but most of the time. As far as the role in the offense, and I'm seeing my time's getting lower here, the argument is that they should have gotten a minimal role instead of a minor role. In my view, it would have been a very appealable issue had I taken it up because of what this court has said in Mendoza about the essential role that drug couriers play in organizations with what they do, taking drugs from point A to point B, and the trust that's put in them. The Hunt case cited by Ms. Alvarez actually helps the government. In Hunt, a lady rented a hotel room and closed the blinds. The court said that's not enough, that they should be a minor or minimal participant because you're not something important like a drug courier. That's what the court says. And hunting, the red light's on, so there's nothing else. Thank you.
How much time, Mr. Hansman? 2.5 minutes, Mr. Hansman.
Probably won't need it all. This was an omission and not a strategic reason for not raising the issue, for the simple reason it could easily have been argued in the alternative. Now, we have some quotes from the Garrett and Allen cases in the reply brief. And Garrett, on pages 5 and 6 of the reply brief, quote Greg Garrett as saying, a logical explanation is that neither Garrett nor his counsel realized that the prior conviction was incorrect. We just take that language to these facts that neither Decker nor his counsel realized the conclusory, realized that this created an issue of the conclusory nature of paragraph 39. Then on page 6 of the reply brief, quote some language from Allen, say, defendant's counsel would not be deficient for failing to raise the objection. As I mentioned before, this is a no-brainer issue. I mean, the government doesn't dispute that paragraph 39 is conclusory. Just as an aside, I've been seeing this in a number of pre-sentence reports. Some of these probation officers are getting careless. But there is no problem with raising this issue in addition to the role in the offense. It did not diminish from arguing the role in the offense. It easily could have been argued in the alternative. And I'd ask you to consider the record in that light. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lorenz?
I believe I used some time.
You have 1 minute, Mr. Lorenz.
I urge the court to review the ostrich instruction with the additional language. I did not see that at trial. I was entrenched in the trial. I took as true and accurate the pattern instruction I received. I thought this was a good time to raise the issue, perhaps to advance the appellate process in the future. Maybe the high probability language will be used in this circuit. But Mr. Blackington is right. I objected to the form of the instruction as it was, and as I do today. We disagreed then and disagree now. Thank you.
Thank you. Either one or both of you appointed in this case? Well, the court appreciates your vigorous representation of your client. Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.